Mention race and the United States in the same sentence, and you're likely to get groans if you're talking about relations between people. Our ability and desire to live in harmony with each other continues to provide many challenges. Our guest this hour writes of his work in this area with a fascinating small-scale experiment at its heart. Max Clow is the author of Race and Social Change, A Quest, A Study, A Call to Action. Max Clow is a developmental psychologist and leadership development director. He is the chief program officer at the New Politics Leadership Academy, which works to get alumni of national service programs to run for political office. Max Clow, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
All right. Any names, by the way, that we'd recognize from the 2018 election who emerged from the National Politics Leader or the New Politics Leadership Academy?
We supported a bunch of candidates. Chrissy Houlihan and Dan McCready in North Carolina is one of the candidates we supported. And you can go to our website. It's my day job is not focused on the book topic, but I invite anybody who's interested, go to New Politics.
All right, that was just
Academy to learn more about our work.
Sure. Just a curiosity question there. So to the book, essentially, this country was born of contradiction. You point out. I mean, so why is it taking us so long to come to grips with it?
It's a great question. I mean, it's from the founding of our country, we had these incredibly noble ideals about, all men are created equal, written by remarkable people like Thomas Jefferson. And the hypocrisy and kind of paradox of America was, from the very founding, people wrote those words while owning slaves. And this is just kind of built into the DNA of our country, is the gap between the ideals we espouse and the lived reality in this country. And I would argue one way to understand American history is an attempt to narrow the gap between those ideals and the reality.
One of the things I noticed that as you describe the development of individuals, you talk about moving from a place of simplicity to complexity. And this is something we'll hit upon probably a few more times in the hour.
Yeah.
So essentially, does the growth of the country resemble the growth of an individual?
That is a great question. I would argue that, yes, there is this, in the broad sweep of history, a symmetry between individuals developing through kind of a, primitive animalistic way of being to more social, evolved ways of being, to something that is emerging around a capacity to connect with the whole and to serve the whole. And I do think if you look at the broad sweep of world history, you can see a development towards that. And certainly my whole book kind of emerging from this empirical research into how social change happens, which I'm sure we'll be talking more about, is this kind of fascinating interconnection between the inner world of the individual and the systems and structures in the world around us.
So we do have to look outside of ourselves, is the point, and consider more than just our own immediate needs and consider the needs of others as we grow older, both as individuals and as societies.
Yes. But the idea here is there's actually a pretty profound interconnection between our current consciousness and the systems and in that we are immersed in the world around us. And it can be a powerful thing to a kind of consciousness to arrive at, to realize that the systems and structures that we're a part of, they are a reflection of our current level of development. And if we shift our own inner consciousness, that seems to be an essential first step on the path towards beginning to shift the systems in the world around us.
Max, you point out that you grew up in a mostly white suburb in Connecticut. What spurred your quest for insight for yourself?
I grew up from my place in the system was a place of privilege as a, middle-class, straight, white male. It was just very clear to me that race was incredibly important to our country, incredibly divisive. And I just was constantly present to this question of, I don't understand how this works. I don't understand how things can happen and people see such different things in the same events, have such incredibly different perspectives on shared experiences. And I really was just lived with that question for years of just, I don't understand how this works. And it led to years of kind of activism and doing programs that were, around understanding race and ultimately to an academic, some time in academia, really studying this from an academic sense.
So then you talk about going on a national service and civil rights tour in your mid-20s with Operating Understanding DC, which really apparently opened your eyes. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was really powerful. So it was a month-long bus tour with 30 teenagers. 15 of them were Black and 15 of them were Jewish. And we did a bus tour of major civil rights locations. So we went to Selma and Philadelphia, Mississippi, where the three, Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman were killed. We went to Memphis and Detroit, places where, important places around civil rights and race in America. And everywhere we went, we had a chance to talk to people who were involved in the civil rights movement there and visit sites. And what was so powerful was to move beyond just studying this, reading books about it or having conversations with my peers who looked a lot like me, to be in this conversation in such an intense way with people who were different from me, with people of color, and really understanding, forging authentic, meaningful, real relationships to understand their perspectives. And it was really, I say the time when the veils of blindness really started to slip away, and I really started to understand how much I was blind to as a result of my place in the system.
Did you think before that summer that you kind of had it knocked? You knew a fair thing about race in America?
I had my theories. I thought I kind of understood my way of what my experience was, but I was always aware of it didn't make sense. It didn't make sense how I could have my perspective and then other people could say such different things. And I really never felt like I was in this place of I understand this, and I still am. Let me be clear. I've realized this is a lifelong journey of discovery and curiosity and understanding. And I'm still in my journey. But I do think I ended up writing this book because I lived with the question and didn't kind of step into what felt like an answer.
A chance for some self-analysis and some group work as well, as raised in Max Clow's book, Race and Social Change, A Quest, A Study, A Call to Action. Max Clow, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join the conversation by email only today. We don't have the phones available for you because there's nobody to man them. Back with Max Clow and Race and Social Change and your emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're delving into how we change society today. It sounds like a big assignment, but Max Clow's been thinking about this for a very long time and taking it from a number of perspectives. He's a developmental psychologist and leadership development scholar. He's the chief program officer at the New Politics Leadership Academy, and he's written a book called Race and Social Change, A Quest, A Study, A Call to Action. This is a conversation we can bring you into by email only today. We don't have anybody to handle the phones, but you're more than welcome to join us at jx@jeffnet.org. Max, let's move on to the central focus of the book, the separation exercises. Where did you first see this?
So I was getting a doctorate in education, and my focus was on youth leadership. And I was looking at different youth leadership programs to understand how they understood youth leadership and taught it. And it was during that research that I stumbled on this program called Camp Anytown, which is a week-long residential program for a very diverse group of high school students. Usually happens at a summer camp or retreat center. And for a week, they engage in some really intense explorations of isms like racism and sexism and that sort of thing. But it was an exercise on the last day of this program that really changed my life. And what I saw that morning was the young people gathered in a circle before breakfast, as they did every day. But then something unusual happened. They were told to separate into groups, whites, Asians, Jews, Latino, LGBTQ, Blacks, and the kids were actually, the participants were actually members of those groups. And then they were told, don't make eye contact with other groups and don't talk to anybody in another group. And then they were sent into breakfast, and the white kids got to go in first, and they got double servings and a big table to sit at. And every group lower in this hierarchy got kind of less food and until the black kids had almost nothing to eat and had to sit on the floor. They didn't get a table. And what it was this attempt to simulate a kind of hierarchical, segregated, Jim Crow-style social system. But the idea was the participants had a chance to challenge these, the system. And between breakfast and lunch, what you saw was the unfolding of this kind of miniature civil rights movement that, in a lot of ways, mirrored events in the real world in some kind of amazing ways. And watching this, I realized that here was a chance to study social change in something as close to kind of an empirically rigorous way as I could imagine, kind of a civil rights movement in a petri dish. And I ended up deciding that this is what I had to focus my dissertation on. I spent the next 4 years of my life researching three more of these and doing the analysis and trying to think about how might this inform how we understand race and social change in the real world.
So let me understand one key component here. Were the participants separated into actual groups or were they randomly assigned?
No, they were actually separated into groups. And the participants looked like they belonged into those groups. So the white kids looked white, and the Latino kids looked Latino. Now, part of the research is there were plenty of participants who just felt like they weren't in the group that they belonged to. They felt like they got shoved into some identity that was not honest for them. But I also think there's kind of that is the way the system works in the real world. It's a lot of it is based on skin color, and you get judged to be in some particular group in ways that might really not relate to your own, the way you understand your identity. But the kids were put into those groups, and the system was kind of set up and enforced, and then the participants had this chance to practice challenging this and changing these systems.
When I first read the account in the book, I began to think about the blue eyes, brown eyes exercise in Iowa in the 60s, which you do mention in the book later on, and began to think, now, wait a minute, I thought people didn't do things like this anymore, but this wasn't a psychology experiment per se, is that
right? Exactly. So it's part of this youth leadership program. It's been run for 70 years. It's been around for a long, long time. And exactly, this was, to be honest, I don't think any grad students working anywhere would get approval to create this kind of experience. But this was happening, and it was a chance to just observe something that was being run by this other organization. And I thought, as a researcher, it was just a remarkable opportunity to understand these issues in a deeper kind of way.
Despite your enthusiasm, did you get some wrestling match with the Harvard authorities when you wanted to replicate what you saw at Camp Anytown?
So, to be clear, I wasn't replicating it. I was just observing it. And I'm still a little bit amazed that I got approval. But my pitch to them was, we're literally just going to stand around and watch this thing that will happen whether we're there or not. We had a little brief survey that was going to add 5 minutes to the extensive 2 to 3 hour reflection experience, debrief experience afterwards. And so they said it was okay. And I'm still kind of amazed. It's definitely research that has not happened for a long time because and I talk about this very clearly in the book, it is ethically challenging. This type of experience for young people is, and I wasn't cavalier about that, and I had my reasons for deciding that I was willing to move forward with this, but it's definitely ethically challenging, an ethically challenging approach to educating people about this.
Are there some safeguards for the people involved in the program? Can they opt out at some point if it's too much for them?
Well, this particular exercise is on the last day of the program. Mm-hmm. And the reasons why I was willing to move forward was because what I saw was some experienced, credentialed educators who really did have kind of the best interests of the kids at heart. And I never saw in the sessions that I went to young people put in situations where the adults there couldn't kind of handle it in a effective, productive way and help them make meaning of what they were experiencing. And and the fact that this has been around for 70 years, and I went looking for evidence that people had really had bad experiences, and at that time there just wasn't a lot out there. So all in all, I thought there's enough value in the learning that could come from this that it was worth moving forward.
This is the Jefferson Exchange. Max Clow is my guest. He's the author of the book Race and Social Change, A Quest, A Study, A Call to Action. So there's another shoe here that goes beyond the separation exercise, which is a year of full-time service you recommend for everyone between the ages of 17 and 24. What would that service look like, and what benefits do you see?
Yeah, so part of my career was 10 years at an organization called City Year, which is an AmeriCorps program, part of, you know, a national service program. And the idea is young adults ages 17 to 24 do a year of full-time service. And City Year in particular is focused on education, so Corps members who work in high-need schools to keep students in school and on track. But there are a lot of different national service organizations. And increasingly, there's like Food Corps to help with food insecurity, and there are environmental corps that do work around environmental sustainability. The idea is young people who have a passion can spend a year working alongside people with different backgrounds to serve the greater good of the country. And it's one of the most powerful, amazing ideas I've heard. To see it in action, I've seen how transformational it is, not only for the communities that are served, but also for the young people doing the service. And, you know, as I say in the book, big problems require big solutions. And this, the racial inequality and the disconnection of this country, the fact that we live in bubbles and really don't know each other, that's been around for a long time. And the idea of making a year of service essentially universal could shift the culture of this country, where everybody just has this experience where they have to get out of their bubble, work alongside people who are different from them, to put the cause of the country first, and step into their responsibilities as a citizen while also forging these relationships across the boundaries that keep us so separated. It's such a simple idea that could do so much good for our country. And I think we need to think at that scale if we're really going to address this issue of race that's been part of our country since we were founded.
But Max, did the last 3 or 4 years really step up your sense of urgency about having this done?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We are so gridlocked and divided and don't know each other. And I also, people talk a lot about rights, but what are the responsibilities we have as citizens? What does it mean to step up and accept for oneself this dedication to serving the country? I just think we need more of it, and national service is a powerful kind of civic rite of passage that could really instill that in a lot of people.
Max Glau is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is called Race and Social Change, A Quest, A Study, A Call to Action. And it focuses on a couple of points, one of the major ones being the separation exercises, where young people are brought together in groups and then divided by ethnic considerations. And there's a hierarchy that develops there. It's just a practice that goes on for about 3 hours. But observing that has led to his work on his doctoral dissertation and led to this book ultimately, too. You can join the conversation by email only at jx@jeffnet.org. Let's get into some of the psychological issues that arise in the processes you're talking about in the book. Obedience and conformity, among other things. And this brings up the psychological experiments of Milgram and Osh, among others.
Correct. Yeah, so when I first saw this separation exercise, I immediately realized it extends this tradition of really well-known and provocative social psychology experiments. And so you mentioned Milgram, and a lot of people are familiar with that, but for folks who aren't, he was a professor at Yale. He was kind of fascinated with Nazi Germany and how ordinary citizens agreed to do terrible things to their fellow citizens. And it was an exercise where he had a subject read questions to somebody in another room. And then if the other person answered wrong, he would flip an electric switch that would administer a shock. Now, the truth was, the person in the other room wasn't actually being shocked, was just an actor. But as far as the subject knew, they were flipping increasingly intense shocks that went all the way up to lethal levels. And the question was, how far would people go in administering this shock if an authority figure said, you have to do this? And, everybody said, this is crazy. 1% of people will do this. Nobody will do it. In the end, about 60% of the participants went all the way up to the lethal level. Like, they obeyed authority even when they thought they were administering a lethal level of shock to somebody they had never met before. And it was a really powerful study around the power of obedience. You also mentioned Ash. That's another study where, a subject was sitting in a room with 6 other people who were all in on this experiment. And somebody at the front of the room showed an image with some lines and, said, there's line A, which of the other lines is equal to line A? And then the six other people would pick a line that was clearly smaller or larger than line A. And the question was, would the subject say what they saw with their own eyes, or would they conform with the statements of their peers? And it's another thing where there were, you know, about a third of people just conformed. Like, they clearly did not go with the evidence of their own eyes and just went along with what the group was saying. And there are classic studies that talk about the power of obedience and conformity. But the power of the separation exercise is suddenly those, you know, social dynamics are just part of a much bigger system. You know, the Milgram and Ash studies are just kind of interpersonal. But what happens when this plays out as part of a much bigger system? I'll pause there.
Well, and that's a great place to pause, because I was going to say the effectiveness of your book is the fact that you walk us very carefully from one subject to the other. So we just learned about the individual issues of obedience and conformity, and then you move us into intergroup relations where there's a whole different set of dynamics going on. So are people much more likely to do things in groups that would be unthinkable for them alone?
Yes, absolutely. And there's another set of classic social psychology experiments that illuminate that. One of the most famous is the Stanford Prison Experiment, where they recreated a prison in the basement of a administrative building in Stanford. And they took, I think it was 22 college students, you know, all kind of well-adjusted, you know, people, healthy, and randomly divided them into prisoners and guards. And this experiment was supposed to run for 2 weeks. They had to shut it off after 6 days because the guards had become so abusive and cruel, and the prisoners had become, were obviously suffering some serious psychological anguish. This was a very difficult thing. And it's the power of kind of total institutions to shape these power dynamics and to turn people who are otherwise really kind of kind, decent, you know, decent people into cruel guards or really despairing prisoners. And it's another classic study of these kind of intergroup dynamics. And another one that you had mentioned before is there's this classic study of the brown-eyed, blue-eyed experiment, which was Jane Elliott, a teacher in the Midwest. The morning after Martin Luther King was assassinated, she wanted to find a way for her classroom of all white students to understand how race worked. And what she came up with was, she showed up at class and said, okay, today the blue-eyed students are superior. They are smarter, they are better, and the brown-eyed kids are inferior in every way. She made the brown-eyed kids wear a collar, and the blue-eyed kids got more time at recess, and at every moment she told them they were amazing. And what you saw was this kind of instant, you know, within an hour or two, this kind of internalization of the privileged kids who thought they were superior and the oppressed kids who thought that they were actually inferior. And what was amazing was after a day and a half of that, she flipped it around and then said, okay, from now on, the brown kids are the superior kids. They're amazing. It's the blue kids who are inferior. And almost instantly, the whole system just shifted. So the kids who thought that they were, you know, the best and superior pretty quickly internalized this sense of, internal inferiority, and vice versa, the kids who had been, you know, oppressed suddenly stepped into this role. And so you see just the power of these systems of privilege and oppression to shape individual behavior. And these are all, this is a long study of classic studies, but the separation exercise takes it to this whole other level of groups of groups undergoing a process of change.
Well, but it seems like with all those earlier experiments you just cited, including the blue eyes, brown eyes, that you know, people can get to a point where they say, oh, that's old stuff. You know, we know that exists now. And oh, that's not me. I mean, is this one of the major issues that people just never question their own starting point?
Yes. Definitely. You know, there's a lot of people who just think I would not fall into that. I would be able to resist those forces. And what these exercises and these experiments challenge us to grapple with is just how profoundly our behavior and choices are shaped by the systems that we are immersed in and the forces around us. And here in the West, in America, we're big believers in the power of the individual and individual freedom. And these experiments really challenge us to honor the power of systemic forces to shape behavior. We're not always as free and independent as we like to think we are.
All right. We've talked about systems and systemic a few times now. You give us two whole chapters on understanding systems, including things like, you know, butterflies flapping their wings in Brazil, that sort of thing. What's the major thing we need to get from understanding systems now?
That they exist and that there is this level of experience. You know, we're used to thinking about interpersonal dynamics, us connecting with one or two people. We're also, I think, pretty familiar with intergroup dynamics and us and them, and there's, different groups. But this idea of there is a complex system that we are all immersed in, this larger system that operates according to certain principles that are not always intuitive. They are not... It takes some understanding to really grasp how these things work, and we are immersed in these things. And it challenges us to achieve a higher consciousness of the reality in which we're immersed. That is the kind of deepest idea of this.
You take us from hierarchy systems with one person on top to more complicated systems. And is there something about how society itself is organized that hinders meaningful change?
You know, one of the things I talk about in the book is if you look at the broad sweep of history, you can see this development from people organizing themselves in these simple hierarchies towards ways of organizing ourselves that are ever more kind of interdependent and equal. And this transformation from simple hierarchy towards more interconnected system unfolds at multiple levels. It unfolds in the family and, you know, relationships between spouses, in the way that's changed over time. It unfolds in organizations and the way organizational kind of hierarchy has shifted over time. And certainly politically, the way, you know, we used to live with pharaohs and kings, and we've shifted towards democracy. Now, part of my training as a developmental psychologist...
Hang on there for just a second. I want to make sure we complete the thought, so yeah. I'll take it on the other side of a break. Max Clough, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Race and Social Change, A Quest, A Study, A Call to Action. Back on the Exchange in a minute five. Final segment of today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. I apologize for the microphone. We're still adjusting it. We're talking to Max Clough about racism and other things that we do to each other in America and how he's observed systems in which people really get what goes on in individual and intergroup relations by observing something called the separation exercise. That is the center of his book, but there's a whole lot more detail about it as well. In his book called Race and Social Change, A Quest, A Study, A Call to Action. You can join the conversation on the Exchange, apparently only by email today. I don't have another person to answer the phones, but join us at jx@jeffnet.org. So let's complete the thought we were taking into the break about the changing of systems over time. We were talking about moving from kings and pharaohs in the past to democracies now.
Yeah, and you can see that trend very clearly when you zoom out to see the broad sweep of history. Now, development is never a simple straight line forward. It takes, you know, two steps forward and one step back, sometimes three steps back. And there is always this craving for comfort that makes change very difficult. And I think that, you know, that's why it's always a challenge and difficult and divisive when there is this shift in the nature of the power structure away from this simple hierarchy towards something more connected. And I think it's a powerful way to understand a lot that's going on in the world today.
So we miss the good old days. I want my country back. All these things that get said when the systems are changing in ways that people don't comprehend because they never had it before.
Right.
So,
you know, and as we move into this interconnectedness and interdependence, this desire to shift backwards to a more simple hierarchical way of being, it's, I think, a powerful way to think about what's going on right now.
Max, I want to ask in particular about where you point up that there is a difference between authority and leadership. What is that, and who most needs to learn that?
Yeah, that is from my academic studies in leadership. It's one of the most important thinkers in the field of leadership is Ronald Heifetz, who's been a professor at the Kennedy School of Government for many years. And this is really his theory, adaptive leadership, that we need to distinguish and disaggregate authority and leadership. And often we use those terms interchangeably. And when we say, you know, the leader, what we mean is the person who is in charge, who is, you know, in the org chart, the person formally in charge of an organization. But he's saying that's a problem. And that often we have people in authority who aren't exercising leadership, and we often see examples of people with no authority, like a Rosa Parks or a Gandhi or a Malala, who have no formal authority and exercise tremendous leadership. And when you define leadership as any effort to kind of mobilize a group to address its most important challenges, that can be done from a position of authority, but there's also a lot of constraints on people in authority. And it can be done from, you know, the margins as well. And it just challenges to think differently about leadership and to recognize that being in charge is not necessarily exercising leadership.
This is why we often get into discussions of people who think they can have greater impact by working outside the political system, for example. They think they can be better leaders by not being figures of authority.
Right, right. You know, there's real constraints on authority. There's also real resources when you have authority. But there's some things that are easier done at the margins and some things that are easier done in the center with power. But what's the key idea is recognizing that we have to think differently about leadership is not necessarily the same thing as authority.
So you make us wait till the fifth chapter of the book to get the descriptions of the separation exercise in more detail. Mm-hmm. Up front, mm-hmm. Are there many cautions you would offer people who would think about doing the separation exercise?
I did not write this book to encourage everybody to do this. I thought it was important for a research perspective, but you definitely should be a highly experienced, credentialed educator. These programs were run by educators and social workers. And I even know for many of these programs, they're moving away from the separation exercise because this is challenging stuff. And my message is not everybody should create this experience for young people in the world. My message is we should be able to learn from this. And hopefully from the organization that has done this, we can all of us arrive at a higher consciousness. But I am not here to encourage everybody to go out and do this sort of experience for themselves.
Who gets credit for creating the separation exercise as is currently known?
I don't know if I don't know if there's one individual. It's something this organization's been doing for decades, you know, 6-7 decades. These sorts of highly experiential educational exercises designed to help people think really deeply about power and privilege and isms. So I don't know exactly who created this, but I do know it's something this organization's been doing for a long time.
You mentioned that you saw it at a place called Camp Anytown, and this was at the end of a week of stuff. And is that one of the key points, too, that the separation exercise is best done after people have spent a long time getting to know people they didn't previously know from parts of life they didn't previously know?
It's important that this is done at a program that is very focused on helping people process difficult experiences and think deeply about these kinds of issues of race and social change. You know, again, I'm not here to say, I'll tell everybody you should go out and
right,
do this
understood.
Sort of program. It's not what my career is about. It's not, but I do think there's tremendous learning for people who care about this, about how to think about it in a more kind of rigorous way.
And so you mentioned the sorting of people by groups. And can you tell us again what the groups are and how people are identified? I mean, do they have to wear collars like the people in the blue eyes, brown eyes experiment, anything like that?
Yeah, so I watched three of these exercises. And in each exercise, they created a different set of groups. You know, so one of them was pretty straightforward of whites, Asians, Jews, Latinos, LGBTQs, blacks. Other ones had more nuance. There was one that had blonde women, non-blonde women, white males, light-skinned blacks, dark-skinned blacks, like a whole different thing. There was another one that had different variations around Latinos, of like first-generation Latinos. And so each one of these things created different structures, but the underlying structure of a simple hierarchy based on race and kind of skin color, with the folks on top having the most privilege and the folks on the bottom having the least, that stayed the same across all of these. And it was kind of simple, just the kids who looked like they fit into those groups. It was not very sophisticated. It was not very thoughtful. And again, there were a lot of participants who felt like they were kind of forced into this group that did not in any way reflect their accurate identity. But again, I think that's a pretty realistic simulation of how this works in the real world. Of you look a certain way and you get treated as though you're a member of this group, and this question of what your actual identity is not necessarily something people consider when they decide how to, you know, what box to put you in.
You mentioned observing this, I think, three times now. So, was there mm-hmm. is there one part that has been consistently the part that provides the most impact to you?
Well, you know, as I talk about in the book, I had expected going into this, I thought it would be a chance to study the people who stepped up and challenged this. And I thought we'd see roughly the same dynamics appear across all three of these things. That was not the case at all. Each one of these unfolded in completely different ways. And you know, there was an underlying pattern. It was amazing to see how long it went before anybody really challenged things. I mean, in every exercise, 2 hours went by before there was a real effort to challenge the systems, just this long period of kind of stasis and conformity. And that was a pattern that held across all. And also, every time it was a member of a group from lower in the hierarchy, a person of color, who was the first to challenge these systems. It was never somebody with privilege. Now, eventually, coalitions formed, and there were allies, and eventually people got involved. But it was very clear that in every case, it was somebody from lower in the hierarchy that was the first to challenge this. But each one of these went in completely different ways, and the question of why they were different illuminates the difficulty of understanding complex systems in really important ways.
There were some parts of this that, did you actually say in the book that like the LGBTQ people were actually physically put in a closet?
Yeah. That was, yes. As I said, this is ethically challenging stuff.
So can the participants get back to a comfort level after it's over? I mean, can they relate to each other in the ways they used to, or is that completely beside the point?
No, it's not beside the point at all. One of the reasons why I was willing to move forward with this was because I saw that after each of these exercises, which are very provocative and challenging, they spent a long time on a debrief, 2, sometimes 3 hours of just kind of processing what had happened to people and making meaning of it in ways that were empowering. And you could just see, I mean, there was a lot of pain, a lot of, you know, for people with privilege, there was a lot of guilt and awakening from blindness. They just didn't see a lot that had happened. And for people of color, there was understandably a lot of anger and, it was difficult to be in that system. But you could see people beginning to see how the whole system worked and beginning to recognize the ways that they can kind of shift it and play a role in changing things. And it's one of the reasons why I chose to move forward, because I did see these sessions, debrief sessions, where people emerged empowered and having made meaning of the pain they had gone through in ways that I think were ultimately productive.
So then how do people take the lessons from the separation exercise, whether they ever participate in one or not, and move those lessons into the real world to take the recognition of how hierarchies and systems set up or may be in place in advance and challenge those?
Yeah, I have a couple chapters of the book that are about really trying to explore what lessons should we take from this exercise that is obviously a simulation and very artificial in a lot of ways. How might it inform how we think about the real world? And one of the key things is just arriving at a higher consciousness that these systems exist. And part of my own journey as a white person was not seeing them, because as the person with the most privilege in the system, the way the system worked was invisible to me. And that was a huge obstacle for me for just kind of moving forward in my own understanding of how race works. And I think that's it's certainly my hope for this book is, I think there's insights for everybody in the system, but obviously my own experience, the path I've walked is as a privileged white person. And I think if we could just get to a higher consciousness that these systems exist and that they're invisible to us for reasons that become clear through what happens in these exercises, that would be a huge leap forward in being able to feel like we're actually living in the same reality. Because I think one of the big problems is just the sense of like we seem to be living on different worlds when listen to the debate and the dialogue around this. But that's part of the way systems work, is they make the people at the top blind to what's going on.
Max, there are all kinds of appendices in the back of your book. What's back there?
Well, you know, it was my dissertation, and there was, for anybody who wants to go to that level, there's the questionnaire that we asked, and there's just some more of the raw data that, you know, it's fascinating to really dive into the voices of the participants. And, you know, as the author, I do a lot of interpretation, but for anybody who is interested in going deeper, I thought it would be helpful to include some of that raw data for anybody who wants to go there. Right. And if you don't want to go there, it's not required reading.
You do have to turn the book sideways, which is not easy in PDF, I discovered. But
Absolutely.
So Max, right. Ultimately, you give the first and final words in the text to Marcel Proust, A. Philip Randolph, Vaclav Havel, and Ta-Nehisi Coates. What is the common thread in their writings that you wanted to convey to the people who read your book?
This idea of changing race as this ongoing process of evolution, that it's about consciousness, and that when you look at the history of civil rights, you see a shift in systems in the world around us. But that shift always begins with some dismantling of the internalized aspects of those systems within the self. And so when we do that work of consciousness, that is a vital beginning to this work of moving forward. And, you know, Ta-Nehisi Coates just talked beautifully about living in a dream and what does it mean to awaken and see the truth, which is both beautiful and terrifying, this country. And I just felt like those ideas were summed up all the key insights from this book in powerful ways.
That really resonates, that you may not like what you wake up to from the dream, but the fact is that reality can be a whole lot more rewarding in the end run. Some great stuff in there. The book is called Race and Social Change, A Quest, A Study, A Call to Action. It's a book by Max Clough, who is a developmental psychologist and leadership development director, now chief program officer at the New Politics Leadership Academy, which works to get alumni of national service programs to run for public office. He's big on national service, too. Max, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for having me.